You forgot to get a family.
She reads a page of her book. The heroine, in her Regency romance, engages in sparkling banter with her dashing suitor. Maybe Sophie should try out internet dating. Maybe she is unrealistically romantic. Maybe she does think her life is a friggin' fairy tale, like her friend Claire had said once when they were both very drunk. Sophie, your problem is that you think life is a friggin' fairy tale. You're so frigging optimistic, you don't just see the glass as half full, you see it as full of pink champagne. And the thing is, the glass isn't full, Sophie. It's half empty. Claire said friggin' a lot when she was drunk. It was funny. She always denied it the next day. Sophie munches her way through her sandwich without really tasting it. She should just come clean with Al and tell him she's sick to death of salmon and salad and she wants something really loopy like curried egg and asparagus. She is in a rut. That's the problem. These sandwiches are a symbol of a life that's going nowhere. Ah, but then again, how could she have forgotten? Her life isn't in a rut. It's at a crossroads, a turning point. Her life actually is like a fairy tale, and Aunt Connie is her fairy godmother. She puts down the book and takes out the letter from her handbag to reread it for about the 100th time. It's weirdly compelling reading something written from the grave, so to speak. You would expect a letter from an old lady to be written in spidery handwriting on lavender-scented notepaper. It's typical of Aunt Connie that hers is perfectly typed in Microsoft Word and looks like a business letter. Apparently she did a computer course when she was 80. Sophie tries to visualize Connie sitting at her computer to type it. She remembers an upright, white-haired woman with powdery, papery skin, a longish, fine-boned face, and intelligent brown eyes that dared you to even think about treating her like an old person. Some elderly people look like they've always been old, but Connie looked like a young person who had aged a great deal. She was frail and moved slowly but impatiently, as if she was driving too slow a car. You could tell that once upon a time she'd been the sort of person who never sat still. It had been a summer's day when Thomas had taken Sophie to visit, and there was the smell of an approaching storm in the air. Sophie was feeling flippant and skittish, while Thomas was in one of his stodgy grown-up moods that made Sophie want to act like a rebellious teenager. He didn't like going to visit his family on Scribbly Gum. He preferred it when they came into Sydney. "It's such a hassle getting out there," he'd say, in an exhausted tone, as if it involved a mountain trek. He'd only taken Sophie out to the island two or three times while they'd been dating, in spite of the fact that Sophie was always hopefully suggesting it. They'd had lunch first with his parents, Margie and Ron. It was Margie who had said it might be a good idea to stop in and say hello to Connie before they caught the ferry back. Connie's husband, Jimmy, had died just a couple of months earlier. Thomas hadn't complained. He was a good, dutiful son. But he was anxious to get off the island. "I just start to feel a bit trapped when I'm here for too long," he'd told Sophie as they walked down the hill towards Aunt Connie's place. "It's so small. You know what I mean?"
"Not really,"
Sophie had answered, taking in a deep breath of salt-tanged air. Connie had seemed graciously, if not effusively, pleased to see them. She made them cinnamon toast and chatted articulately with Thomas about his favourite topics, federal politics and cricket. Sophie could sense in Connie a terrible, restrained grief for her husband. She had sad, pink half-moons under her eyes, and Jimmy's presence was still everywhere, an old man's cardigan draped over the back of a chair, a pair of muddy black boots on the front porch, framed prints of newspaper articles he'd written, including, of course, his story breaking the news about the Munro baby mystery. Connie had given Sophie a slow, painful tour of the house, and she'd seemed to appreciate it when Sophie said how much she liked it, so Sophie hadn't held back with her compliments. Not that they weren't genuine. She'd never been in a house which had appealed to her so much before. She'd never been in someone else's home and thought to herself, "I'd give anything to live here." "Oh, dear," thinks Sophie now. "Perhaps I didn't just think that. Maybe I actually said it out loud to Aunt Connie." Still, she hadn't meant it as a hint. She'd just honestly fallen in love with that house. Ever since she got the news from Thomas, she has felt like hugging herself with glee each time she remembers something new. The jasmine-covered archway at the top of the garden path leading to the front door. That gigantic green claw bathtub. Honey-coloured floorboards. Stained glass windows reflecting reds and blues in the late afternoon sun. Glittering pieces of river from every window. The tiny looping staircase to the main bedroom. The window seat where you could curl up with a Regency romance and a Turkish delight. It really was like a house in a fairy tale. But is it wrong to accept it? She reads the letter one more time, trying hard to be objective, trying to see herself through Aunt Connie's eyes. She lingers over the P.S. She's trying not to take the P.S. too seriously. Nothing will come of it, of course. It's just a bit of fun. Just a bit of heart-lifting fun. Sophie's mobile rings, and she answers it, her mouth full of sandwich, still thinking about the P.S. "Sophie, this is Veronica." Sophie makes a strangled sound. "Oh, hi," she says brightly and falsely, as guilty as a murderer. "I just thought it was polite to let you know that we'll be contesting Aunt Connie's will. Everybody in the family is terribly hurt by what you've done." Sophie holds the phone slightly away from her ear. Veronica always speaks too loudly on the phone, and when she is angry, it's even more painful than usual. "Just remind me exactly what I've done." "Ha! You know, I used to pride myself on being a good judge of character, but it just goes to show how wrong you can be. I would never have thought you capable of this. Manipulating a defenseless old lady like that. I thought you were a friend. I even thought you were a good friend. But, oh, I see exactly what you are now. You may think you can walk all over Thomas, but the rest of us aren't quite so stupid. I just got off the phone from my cousin Grace, and she could hardly bear to talk about it. She was so appalled by what you've done." "Really?" For some reason, the thought of Grace, who Sophie barely knows, thinking badly of her, is more distressing than Veronica, her friend of many years, thinking she is an evil manipulator of old ladies. Sophie has only met Grace just once, years ago, at Veronica's wedding, but she has a schoolgirl crush on her. Grace is beautiful, achingly, ridiculously beautiful, the unfair sort of beauty that made it a painful pleasure just to look at her. Plus, there is that comment in Aunt Connie's letter about Grace. "Tell Grace not to be upset with me," she says frivolously. "Tell her I'm a big contributor to her royalties. I'm always buying her books as presents." Ever since Veronica had mentioned that Grace wrote and illustrated a series of children's picture books about an evil little elf called Gublet, Sophie has been buying her books as presents for her friends' children. The illustrations are gorgeous, full of detail, and an intriguing touch of menace that kids, especially the brattier ones, seem to love. The Goblet books only add to Grace's mystique. "You're not even taking this seriously," explodes Veronica. "I have nothing more to say to you, Sophie. I forgave you for what you did to Thomas, but this is genuinely unforgivable. My family will be fighting this all the way to the highest court in the land, and I will not say another word to you in my lifetime." "Starting from now?" asks Sophie. But Veronica is true to her word and hangs up. She must be genuinely upset to actually stop talking. Whenever Veronica gets on her high horse about anything, from her opinion on a movie to her views on abortion, it brings out a flip, sarcastic side of Sophie's personality. Afterwards, she always feels bad, and now she feels particularly guilty. Part of her had been thinking that this whole thing with Aunt Connie's house had been all about destiny. It had been her destiny to become friends with Veronica, even though it was an annoying friendship at times. It was her destiny to date Veronica's brother Thomas, even though it had all ended so horribly. It was her destiny to live in Aunt Connie's wonderful home on Scribbly Gum Island. That was the final payoff. She deserved it. But now it occurs to Sophie to wonder if perhaps she had been subconsciously manipulating her destiny. She remembers when she first met Veronica at a friend's baby shower. Sophie was supervising the cutting of the cake. One of hers, of course, featuring a pair of baby booties made out of cupcakes, when she heard somebody saying in a clear, sharp voice that she'd grown up on Scribbly Gum Island. "Did you really?" Sophie had chimed in, leaning across another woman to hand the stranger a piece of booty. "What was that like?" Sophie had a thing about Scribbly Gum Island. She'd adored it ever since her first visit on a school excursion when she was a child. She disagreed passionately with people who described the island as a bit twee, don't you think? She'd done the Alice and Jack tour a dozen times, staring with fresh fascination at the clothes still hanging in the cupboard, the baby's crib, the newspaper sitting open on the 15th of July 1932, the crossword halfway completed. She'd picnicked at Sultana Rocks, had birthday lunches at Connie's Cafe, and convinced friends that the blueberry muffins and hot chocolates were worth the train and ferry ride, especially on a cold winter's day. She once had a terrible fight with a boyfriend when they were holidaying in the Greek islands over whether the view from Kingfisher Lookout on Scribbly Gum Island was prettier than the view from their hotel window in Santorini. She said it was. He said she was deliberately being ridiculous. When Sophie learned that Veronica was the granddaughter of the Munro baby, she was as thrilled as if she'd met a favourite celebrity. It was true that Veronica had been the one to rather aggressively pursue the friendship. She had invited Sophie to lunches and drinks and bullied her into doing a belly dancing course with her. Sophie had enjoyed the course. She thought it was a hoot. When she managed to restrain her gales of laughter, she was rather good at it. The teacher's pet, in fact. Veronica was the worst in the class, but took it all terribly seriously, listening intently to the instructions and zealously trying to jiggle her skinny hips. That was when Sophie became fond of Veronica. Sophie's other friends would have been collapsing with giggles or refused to really try. There was something endearing about Veronica's hopeless persistence. Still, the Scribbly Gum connection probably helped make the friendship more attractive and made up for Veronica's more aggravating characteristics, such as her energy-draining intensity over everything. One of the guys at work had openly admitted to cultivating a friendship with someone who owned a yacht. What if Sophie had subconsciously been doing the same with Veronica, even while she was congratulating herself on her saintly fortitude. But what would she have been hoping to achieve? Veronica hadn't even taken her to meet her family on Scribbly Gum Island. Oh, why would you want to go there? Boring! It wasn't until Sophie had started dating Veronica's brother that she got to visit. Unless, of course, dating Thomas had been the next step in her dastardly plan. She looks at her watch. It's time to get back to work. She has a meeting at 2. She will read Connie's letter to her parents tonight over dinner and see what they think. If they say it's wrong to accept the house, she won't take it. I'm a good person, Sophie reminds herself. Everybody loves me. I give to charity. I recycle. I buy things I don't want from door-to-door salesmen. I've been a bridesmaid 7 bloody times. I'm not the sort of person to manipulate an old lady. No! Sophie looks up to see the angelic blonde toddler in the middle of a ferocious tantrum, flipping his body back and forth while his mother tries to strap him in his stroller and yells at the other child to stay still, Harry! The daddy has escaped, striding back to work, his tie swinging. Actually, thinks Sophie, as she stands up and brushes crumbs off her skirt, she's quite looking forward to her meeting on graduate recruitment strategies. Chapter 14. Gublet McDublet was a very naughty little elf. Every day, his mum said to him, "Now, Gublet, do you think it's going to be a good Gublet day or a bad Gublet day?" Every day, Gublet answered the same way, "A good Gublet day." But guess what? Every day turned out to be a bad Gublet day. One day, Gublet said, "Oh, fuck it, Mum, you're a boring old hag," and he took a knife and lopped off his sweet mummy's head. Grace looks at the line drawing she has scribbled of a ferociously grinning elf with blood dripping from a butcher's knife. Oh, dear. It isn't going to be a good Gublet day for Grace, is it? Next thing, she'll have Gublet raping his best friend Melly the music box dancer, ripping off Melly's sparkly tutu and giving it to her right there on the pink satin music box floor. Where are these perverse and strangely bitchy thoughts coming from? They aren't at all appropriate for a new mother. Her head should be full of lullabies and bunnies, not blood and rape. Grace pulls the sheet of paper from her sketchbook and screws it up into a hard, ridged ball. It is 11 a.m. on her second day at home alone with the baby. He is asleep upstairs, fed and burped and clean and swaddled. "Like wrapping a burrito," Callum said when the nurse showed them at the hospital. And, most importantly, breathing. She is successfully keeping him alive, and so far she hasn't broken any important rules or made any fatal errors. But still, every move she makes continues to feel fake and forced, like she's pretending to be this baby's mother, and the real mother will be along soon to look after him properly. She can't shake a constant underlying feeling of terror. All new mothers are nervous, she tells herself. Not like this. Yes, of course they are. It's perfectly normal. I am perfectly normal. I am a new mother sitting down with a cup of tea. She tries again to draw Gublet's familiar features. He stares back at her with a new, cold, bland expression. This hasn't happened to her before. It has always been such a pleasure to work on Gublet. She was never stuck for inspiration. All she needed was time. Grace has been working on her Gublet McDublet books for over 4 years now. He started as a doodle. Whenever she was talking on the phone, a wicked elf character would appear on her notebook. She became fond of him, and eventually, just for fun, not really thinking too hard about it, she made up a funny story about Gublet's first day at school. It was Callum who secretly sent it off to a children's book publisher he'd picked out of the Yellow Pages, and, astonishingly, they agreed to publish it in a hard-bound picture book for 3 to 5-year-olds. So far, she hasn't made enough money to be able to give up her day job as a graphic designer for a company that specializes in beautiful annual reports. There isn't that much money in the children's picture book market, unless you are phenomenally successful, and besides which, so far each of the 2 Gublet books has taken her over 2 years to complete. 2 years? People always say with disbelief and a hint of derision. They seem to think she should be able to knock one off in a couple of weeks, when each illustration is actually an oil painting on canvas, a labour of love one generous reviewer described as exquisite works of art. When her first book was launched, the local preschool invited her to read her Gublet book to a group of cross-legged, squirming 4-year-olds. She was nervous. Children made her feel huge and awkward, and she was never sure exactly how to correctly pitch her conversation for their age group, worrying that she was speaking to them as if they were retarded or deaf. When friends suddenly, bizarrely, put their heavy-breathing toddlers on the phone to talk to her, Grace would more often than not just sit there in tongue-tied silence. What in the world was she meant to say? So, what have you been up to lately? Here you just learned to walk, hey? How's that going then? She was convinced the preschoolers wouldn't like her. After all, people generally didn't. Friends were always cosily informing her how much they disliked her at their first meeting. You just seemed so cold and standoffish. The children probably wouldn't hide their dislike like grown-ups. They'd probably boo and hiss. Maybe they'd all suddenly attack her like rabid little rats. Who knew what they'd do? They were another species. She was sure that she sounded ridiculous as she read her own words to the preschoolers. But then she got her first laugh. It was the part where Gublet jumped up and down on his mum's yucky pumpkin pie like a trampoline. The children whooped. One got up to demonstrate how he would jump in a similar situation. The teacher, sitting at the back of the room, gave her a thumbs up, as if she knew Grace had been nervous, and the kids sat back down and looked up at her with open, flower-like faces, eyes shining expectantly, ready for the next funny part. So this was what people saw in children. After she'd finished reading, when the teacher asked them if they had any questions, every hand shot in the air, straining high for her attention. "Is Gublet so naughty all the time because he wishes he didn't have pointy ears? Would Gublet like to come to my party? Do you think he would jump up and down on my cake? My mum would be pretty cross with him." "Gublet is funny when he's naughty. I laughed so much. I laughed until forever." That time when Gublet's mum sent him to the moon for being naughty and he rang up Melly and then they ran away to Mars, well, guess what? That happened to me too. But guess what? It wasn't real. It was a dream. Hearing a client say, "The CEO was quite impressed with your design concepts," could never compare with the intense pleasure Grace felt hearing a 4-year-old say, "I laughed until forever." So that was the day she decided that what she really wanted to do with her life was work full-time on her Gublet books. When she got pregnant and her mother had offered them her house on Scribbly Gum, she and Callum had gone out to dinner and worked out a whole life plan. She would take maternity leave from the graphic design studio, but hopefully she'd never have to go back. When the baby... It was so amazing to think that there really would be an actual real baby, separate from herself. Was asleep, she'd work serenely on the third Goblet book and get it finished by the end of the year. Meanwhile, Callum would take on extra music students outside of school hours. The builders would do what they said they were going to do, and their dream home in the mountains would be finished in plenty of time for them to move in when Laura returned from overseas. Within 2 years, they would save up enough money so that Callum could start up his music school for adults. They would work out a sensible investment plan. They would take multivitamins and drink carrot, celery, and apple juice every day. They would need to buy a juicer. They would be healthy, happy, and successful. They would have one more child. Maybe even two more. Why not? So far, it seemed pretty easy. Callum wrote it all down on a notepad. Grace added amusing sketches to illustrate each point. They ate duck with crab meat sauce. They were pleased with themselves. Grace draws her pencil back and forth across the page in deep zigzags, remembering that night. Their plans had been so very, very pat. Hadn't they? She remembers how she'd poked at her stomach to make the baby kick back, and how she and Callum had laughed, high on the possibilities of their future. What was so different about her imagined life from the reality of it? It's all going according to plan. Here she is with her baby sleeping, sitting at her mother's dining room table, ready to do Goblet. And everything seems bland and pointless. Just plain old yawning dull. Goblet. A trite, not especially original picture book in an overcrowded market which doesn't sell that well or make that much money. Her marriage. She remembers all that fuss she'd made when she first met Callum. So prissy and girly. Oh, I just love him so much. Did she really feel any of that? He is just a man, for God's sake. A slovenly man who doesn't do enough around the house, who is getting a bit fat around the tummy, who has really horrible breath in the morning, who is infuriatingly convinced he is always right. She says out loud, "Oh, stop being such a bitch, Grace." She remembers the day the call came through from the publisher about Goblet. "There's someone on the phone for you," Callum had said, failing to repress an enormous grin. Grace, mystified, had taken the phone, and Callum had carefully watched her face until he saw her start to smile. At which point he'd performed a wild, silent victory dance around the kitchen. How can she not love Callum? Well, she does love him. Of course she loves him. The baby is crying. She looks at her watch. It has happened again. 2 hours vanished. This is not normal. Chapter 15. From inside the warm restaurant, Sophie looks down at the crowds of people walking back and forth along the quay, heads bent against a chilly wind. A nondescript couple, rugged up in black coats, hurrying and holding hands, slowly metamorph into the familiar figures of her parents, like a special effect in a movie. Sophie smiles involuntarily and tries to keep watching them with the eyes of a stranger. A perfectly ordinary, middle-aged, quite stylish, definitely married couple with a relaxed, happy air about them, as if they are on holidays. They are both on the short side, giving them a cute, compact look. The woman stops and demonstrates something. a hammering movement with hands. The man shrugs, grabs her hand, and pulls her along towards the restaurant. Sophie laughs to herself and feels the anticipation of relief. She is going to read them Aunt Connie's letter and let them decide what she should do. Whatever they say, it will be said with unconditional, soothing approval of Sophie. She watches them come in the door, pink-faced and peeling off their coats. Her father, in a smart grey suit with a red tie, has a roundish face, old-fashioned gold glasses, and a lovely smile, which he gives his wife as he helps her with her coat. Her mother, who is wearing a soft blue dress, is checking herself in the glass-mirrored wall and trying to smooth down her irrepressibly curly hair. The wind has given her a slightly crazed look. They chat away to the maitre d' as if he is an old, dear friend, and there is a loud burst of laughter. Sophie's parents create flurries of laughter wherever they go. Finally, they look Sophie's way and she raises a hand. Her parents beam in unison, as if it has been months since she'd seen them last, not a mere 2 weeks. Sophie's friend Claire, on meeting the Honeywell family for the first time, said, "Now I get it why you're so popular. You've always been adored. You expect to be adored, and so you are." "I do not expect to be adored. Anyway, all parents love their children," retorted Sophie, feeling embarrassed because she knew it was true. "Not like yours love you," said Claire. "It's borderline dysfunctional." "Hello, darling," says her mother. "That's a gorgeous new top. Can you believe my hair? I look like I've been electrocuted." She bulges her eyes and vibrates her head to demonstrate her point. "Hello, Soph," says her father. He pulls out a chair for his wife and kisses Sophie on the cheek. "Your mother accepts full responsibility for our lateness." "No drink yet. 2 points off?" "This lighting is a bit too moody, I think. I can hardly see you." Every third Thursday, Sophie's father takes his wife and daughter out for dinner at a carefully chosen restaurant. The Honeywell family specializes in fine dining. They'd applied their own elaborate rating system to restaurants in Paris, London, New York, and, of course, Sydney. It is one of their shared family hobbies, along with opera, Scrabble, and reality TV. Her mother, Gretel, enjoys telling people about how they used to take Sophie out to restaurants when she was just a toddler. They would prop her up on 2 cushions so she could reach the table, and she'd be good as gold, solemnly pretending to read the menu, which was twice the size of her. The waiters made her pretend cocktails, exactly the same pink color as her mummy's. Sophie also smoked pretend lolly cigarettes, just like mummy and daddy's, blowing pretend smoke out the side of her mouth. Little actress. But Gretel generally leaves out that part of the story because it makes people stop saying, "Oh," and say uneasily, "Oh." Plus, Gretel doesn't actually like to think about the number of cigarettes they smoked in their daughter's presence. Sophie only has to give the tiniest cough before Gretel is clutching her husband's arm. "Listen to that. Passive smoking. What were we thinking? We probably destroyed her poor little lungs." Sophie's dad's name is Hans. Hans and Gretel. When they were teenagers, they had mutual friends who found the idea of them becoming a couple so uproarious that they engineered a meeting. Hans and Gretel were determined not to like each other, but accidentally fell hopelessly in love the moment they were simultaneously pointed out by chortling friends on opposite sides of the Prince Albert Park ice skating rink. If it had been a movie, it would have switched to slow motion and a romantic soundtrack as Hans and Gretel glided over the ice into each other's arms. In reality, Neither of them had been skating before, so they bravely made their way across the rink with spaghetti legs and flailing arms, met in the middle, went to shake hands, and crashed to their bottoms on the ice. "I hit my tailbone," said Gretel. "I was in excruciating pain, but I was so blissfully happy, it was like I was drunk. I knew, you see, and I knew he knew, too." I quickly peeked to look at my watch, so I'd always remember the exact moment that I met my husband. 2:20, 11th of June, 1962. It doesn't matter how many times Gretel tells Sophie this story, they still both sniff at the end. Not that it takes much to make mother or daughter sniff. They are, after all, addicted to anything romantic. Romantic comedies, Regency romances, romantic TV ads. The Hans and Gretel romance ended with them living happily ever after. Well, pretty much, anyway. The only mildly unhappy thing in their lives is that they couldn't have any more children after Sophie. Both Hans and Gretel came from small families, and they had planned to have a few dozen kids. But, as her mother says cheerfully, it just wasn't meant to be. And besides which, they hit the jackpot first time. It seems to Sophie that her parents are the sort of parents who should have had a whole brood of shouting, messy, sticky-fingered children. Her mum should have been one of those distracted mums, serenely presiding over a crammed table, dishing out gigantic, nutritious casseroles, ruffling one kid's hair, slapping another one's knuckles. Her dad should have been one of those dads flipping sausages on the barbecue in between tossing kids in the air like juggling balls and saying funny things to visitors like, "Who are you? You one of mine?" While his own children squirmed, "Oh, Dad!" Sophie herself would have been the perfect older sister, kind and loving, firm but fair. She would have let her younger sisters use her makeup under supervision and dispensed judicious dating advice. She would have driven her dear little brothers to their soccer games and helped them with their homework. She probably would not have had a blushing problem if she had been an older sister. But instead, there is just Hans, Gretel, and Sophie. They are like three guests at a party where no one else has turned up, doing their best to create the impression of a much larger, rowdier group, and doing so well that it turns out to be the party everyone is sorry they missed. People always comment on how extraordinarily close a family they are, how much fun they have, how they seem like three best friends. When Sophie was a child, her friends were thunderstruck when she invited their parents to join in with games, just like her own parents did. She thought all parents were just extra large-sized kids. How she blushed when this terrible faux pas was pointed out to her. "Mum isn't even allowed inside the cubby house, Sophie. She can't play with us." That's sort of weird. This Thursday night, the Honeywells are trying out a new restaurant at the Quay, with ceiling-to-floor windows revealing the white sails of the Opera House like a gigantic gold-lit sculpture. The three of them sit in grave silence, studying heavy, hard-bound menus with sighs of indecision and lots of flipping back and forth of pages. They put their menus down, frown, pick them up again, and continue flipping. Finally, hands clasped over closed menus, they each present their selections as if they are explaining complex mathematical solutions. "Confit of Tasmanian ocean trout with roe," says Gretel, "followed by marinated scampi with pawpaw, cucumber and tonburi." Sophie and Hans shake their heads in admiration. "Salad of sea scallops, says Sophie, followed by, if you're thinking the salmon, Dad, you'd be wrong, lobster ravioli with tomato and basil vinaigrette. Oh, no. Her father puts a hand to his forehead. I had the ravioli. Back to the drawing board, darling, says Gretel. There is a rule that nobody ever has the same dish. It is an unfair rule because Hans always chivalrously insists that Gretel and Sophie say their choices before him. He heaves a dramatic sigh, pushes his glasses back up his nose and picks up his menu, squeezing his bottom lip with two fingers. In the meantime, Sophie's mother has tipped slightly back on her chair with a dazed expression on her face. It means that a conversation at the next table has caught her attention. She, like Sophie, is an avid eavesdropper. Sophie looks to see who she is listening into. It is clearly a family group. Grandparents, daughter and son-in-law. Or son and daughter-in-law. Gretel will confirm in a few minutes. Together with a silent, unseen baby in a pram. Sophie can sense by the way they are all sitting slightly self-consciously with their heads cocked towards the pram that the baby is a new addition to the family. It is bad enough that Sophie's parents have only one child, but now they are in their early 60s when they can quite reasonably expect to be grandparents, their only daughter isn't even in a relationship. Sophie's mother has a group of friends who she's been playing tennis with for over 20 years, and Gretel is the only one in that group who isn't a grandma. Sophie can't bear to think about her mother politely listening to all those women showing off about their grandchildren. The worst part of it is that her parents never put pressure on her. There are never any loaded questions like, "Met anyone interesting lately?" Sophie would feel less guilty if Gretel was like her friend Claire's pitiful mother who nags and cajoles and begs, accusing Claire of deliberately not having children just to spite her. The mozzarella and chili salad, followed by the slowly poached veal shank. If anyone is still interested, Hans closes his menu. Your turn to choose the wine, Soph. Gretel leans forward and lowers her voice to a hoarse, secret agent whisper. First night out with colicky new baby, she informs Sophie. Mother-in-law about to make daughter-in-law cry. Fascinating. Hans doesn't approve of his wife and daughter's eavesdropping habits. Do you think we could concentrate on our own family now? I am terribly sorry, says Gretel in a royal family accent. How frightfully rude of me. I happen to think it is, said Hans sternly, although Sophie knows he is trying not to laugh. Nobody chuckles louder than Hans at his wife's repertoire of accents and funny voices. Sophie watches her parents acting as if they have just reached that nice stage in a relationship where you pretend to be annoyed with each other in public. There is a mean feeling in her chest, like heartburn. It takes her a few seconds to identify that it is actually envy. She puts down her glass of water with a thud. Well, this is getting beyond a joke. Yesterday, she'd been pounding away on the treadmill at the gym, watching a documentary on one of the television screens. It was about a woman with no arms and no legs who had to get around on a skateboard. A touching story of courage in the face of terrible odds. But even while she was blinking back tears of sympathy, Sophie had, just for a second, actually felt a tiny bit envious of the woman. Why? Because of her nice, good-looking, fully limbed husband. As punishment, she had given herself an extra 20 minutes on the treadmill to show her appreciation of her two rather short but perfectly functional legs. Still, she couldn't quite get the thought out of her mind. If an armless, legless woman on a skateboard could find a man, surely Sophie was doing something very, very wrong. How did this woman meet him? Pull on his trouser leg as she rolled by him in a nightclub? Now here she is, feeling jealous of her own sweet parents. She is a very bad person. A spoiled only child. A brat. She says, "Don't you want to hear my letter from Aunt Connie?" Oh, yes. Her parents are immediately all attention. Sophie takes the letter out of her handbag, clears her throat, and reads. Dear Sophie, a waitress appears at their table as though she has been waiting for this very signal. Good evening. Did you need any more time, or may I take your order? My daughter is just reading a letter from someone who left her a house. Gretel beams up at her. This woman barely knew her. It's all very intriguing. Sophie's mother believes discretion is the height of rudeness. Oh, well, that is, intriguing. The waitress is obviously unsure whether to make her face happy or sad about this revelation, and settles for confused. What's more intriguing is whether the veal comes with vegetables. Hans looks up over the top of his glasses and treats the waitress to his sweet smile. When their orders are taken and Hans and Sophie have managed to restrain Gretel from generously inviting the waitress to stay and listen to the letter, Sophie begins again. Dear Sophie. Well, my dear, today I decided to leave you my house. It is an odd decision, but not, let me assure you, a whimsical one or a senile one. I have thought about it at length. No doubt this decision will create something of a hoo-ha, and Veronica will be in a state, but it is my house, and I've decided I want you to have it. It would have been easier if you had stayed with Thomas, but I'm not at all surprised. In fact, I'm rather pleased that you didn't. I don't really know you from a bar of soap, do I? But there was something about you and your reaction to my house. You know that my husband Jimmy and I built it together. It is very special to me. Every brick, every floorboard, every windowsill has a memory for me. Goodness me, I smile when I look at that silly toilet roll holder. As much as I love them, I couldn't bear to think of Veronica crashing about, pulling things down, or Thomas carefully repainting the place in some dreadful neutral colour. As for Grace, I don't think she should live on the island at all. Afraid it has unhappy memories for her. I haven't stopped missing Jimmy since the day he died. It's like waking up with a stomach ache every day. Well, this'll probably sound quite balmy, but there is something about you that reminds me of my husband. The reason I fell in love with Jimmy, the reason I'm still in love with him, was his capacity for joy. That man could be happy in a way my family has never been. I'm afraid we can be a miserable lot. There was a moment when you were standing out on my balcony and you saw our resident kookaburra. You looked back towards me and I thought, she's got it too, Jimmy's joyful look. I want someone joyful to live in my house. I also think the island needs someone like you, someone with that rare capacity for joy. It will be good for the house. Good for everyone. Probably good for the business. By the way, if Grace is still living on the island, perhaps you could consider a friendship. I think you would like her. Please excuse me for meddling. As my sister Rose will tell you, I've been a terrible meddler all my life. Still, as she may one day tell you, it seems to have all worked out rather well. Well, that's all I have to say. Enjoy the house. I have attached a list of instructions you may find helpful. Don't throw them away, or I shall haunt you. It was such a pleasure to meet you, Sophie, love. Yours sincerely, Connie Thrum. P.S. I'm sure you have dozens of beaux, but there is a rather nice young man I feel would be very appropriate for you, who I hope you will meet as a result of moving into my house. I won't say who he is, because although most of my meddling has been successful, I've had no luck at all matchmaking Rose, and I've been trying to do so for over 70 years. All I'm saying is keep an eye out for him. Sophie looks up to see her mother smiling radiantly, as if she has just read out a glowing report card, while her dad has his shrewd, fatherly, "nobody's going to put one over me" expression. "A rare capacity for joy," says Gretel. "That's lovely. I expect you inherited it from me." "Well, I've changed my mind. I think you should absolutely accept the house." Hans says, "I'm betting she put in some sort of clause that says you can't sell it. She obviously wants you to live in it. Now, how expensive is the upkeep? Is the place falling apart? That's what I'd like to know. And do you really want to be living there, Sophie, spreading your message of joy?" "Sarcasm," scolds Gretel. They are interrupted by the arrival of the wine, a Gewürztraminer Sophie had selected. She tastes the wine as she's been trained to do since she was 13 years old. Swirl, sniff, slosh in mouth, reflect with serious expression, smile decisively up at waiter and say graciously, "Lovely. Thank you." "It's not exactly a convenient location," continues Hans when the wine is poured. "They don't allow cars on the island, do they? How would you get to work?" "There's a ferry," explains Sophie. "The families all have their own motorboats, and they keep their cars in a padlocked parking area on the mainland. So I'll take my boat across, hop in my car, drive to the station, and catch the train into the city." She tries hard to look casual, so her father won't guess how enchanted she is by this idea. But her mother spoils it by clasping her hands and saying out loud everything that Sophie is secretly thinking. "How wonderful! I can just see it. The sun shining on the water, your own little boat chugging across the river while you wave hello to other islanders." "That will all seem very romantic right up until the first day it rains," says Hans. "Or you're running late for work. Or you're coming home late at night." Her mother says, "Oh, no, darling, I don't think she could drive her little boat late at night. I don't think boats have headlights, do they?" Hans gives her an exasperated look. "Well, she can't stay home every night, can she?" "She could come and stay with us if she's out late." "That's hardly practical." "I don't see why not." "Because she might want to... you know, she might have a... well, she might like... well, she could... bugger it, you know what I'm trying to say." "Oh, well, she could stay at his place," says Gretel blithely, and then frowns. "If he seems nice and clean." "Mum, Dad, I'm very grateful that you're both so concerned about my sex life, but I'm sure I'll be fine," says Sophie. These assumptions by Aunt Connie that she has dozens of beaux and by her parents that she actually has sex on a regular basis are both flattering and depressing. There is a disturbance at the table next to them. The younger woman stands up suddenly with a face she is trying hard not to let crumple and walks off quickly to the ladies. I told you so, whispers Greta, looking sympathetic and triumphant. I wonder if I should go after her. I might not even get the house, continues Sophie. Veronica rang me up and told me she's going to fight me all the way to the highest court in the land. Her father snorts. I've checked up on it. I really don't think she has a chance. One, she's not even related to this woman. Connie doesn't have any living relatives, does she? Yes, she does, says Gretel, the younger sister who was with her when they found the baby. The face painting lady. Remember we met her when we took Sophie to the island when she was young. What was her name? Rose, says Sophie. Hans says, well, even if Rose wanted to contest it, she'd need to prove that Connie wasn't of sound mind, or that she was somehow manipulated. It's clear from her letter that wasn't the case. She just took a liking to you. Anyway, this is all premature until you hear from the lawyers and what the will actually says. But I don't know, says Sophie. Is it morally right for me to take the house? Of course it is, says her mother. Now I've heard that letter, I've decided it would be morally wrong not to take it. Connie wanted you to have it. If you think you could be happy living there, then you should, says Hans. It's a windfall, darling, that's all. No need to feel guilty about windfalls. I'm going to check on that poor girl, says Gretel. The next day, Sophie models possible outfits to wear to Aunt Connie's funeral, while her friend Claire lies on Sophie's bed eating a gigantic bag of salt and vinegar chips. Claire can eat and eat and eat and still retain a malnourished look. She looks a bit like a junkie, a skinny young rock chick, although she's actually a 42-year-old physiotherapist. Is the funeral on the island? She asks, as Sophie stands in front of her wardrobe flicking through hangers. No, the island is tiny, says Sophie. It's Sydney's smallest suburb. Only 6 houses. Haven't you ever been there? Nope. You've never done the tour of the Alice and Jack house? How could I if I've never been there? Right. Well, when I live there, you can come and visit me. We'll do the tour together. I'll make you cinnamon toast. At the thought of living in that house, walking out onto that balcony in her PJs, and having a cup of tea in the morning sun, watching the reflections of the gum trees in the river, Sophie feels an intense shot of pleasure. It will be bliss. It is like the life she's always wanted without ever knowing it. And this lovely old woman has just handed it to her. Here, take this life. A glittering gift. Like something in a fairy tale. There's a kookaburra that comes and sits on the balcony every night, she tells Claire as she pulls a shirt over her head and zips up a skirt. I know, says Claire. You told me. Sounds thrilling. That outfit is far too insipid. Sophie looks down at her grey skirt and white shirt. I think insipid might be exactly the right look. I'm not even sure if I should go. It's not as if I would have gone if she hadn't left me the house. But it seems ungrateful not to be there now. So I sort of want to be there and not be there at the same time. Plus, there will be Thomas and his wife and Veronica and all the family who I haven't seen since the breakup. Oh, God, it's going to be excruciating. Claire says, wear the black dress you wore when you snogged that fat guy at Melissa's christening. He wasn't fat, he was stocky. Anyway, I don't want to wear black, says Sophie. People will think I'm pretending to be sad when they all know I didn't really know her. She shoves Claire's hand aside so she can reach in the bag for some chips. 16, 17, 18, says Claire. At Sophie's request, she is counting the number of chips Sophie eats, with orders to stop her at 20. I think you look really sexy in that black dress, says Claire. 19, 20, that's it, no more. She folds the top of the chip bag with a straight, firm crease and begins licking her fingers efficiently, one by one, like a cat grooming itself. Sophie will not get another chip now, even if she goes down on her hands and knees and begs for it. I don't want to look sexy. I want to look demure and non-manipulative. You should look sexy, says Claire. He might be there. Who? Oh, don't pretend you haven't thought about it. The guy Aunt Connie thinks would be right for you, your new beau. In fact, Sophie hasn't thought about him being at the funeral at all. When she thinks about him, which she does quite a lot, she imagines him knocking on her door a few days after she's moved into Connie's house. She'll be wearing overalls, with one strap dangling down, and her hair will be tousled and cute. She might have a darling smudge of dirt on one cheek. He will walk in, probably wearing muddy boots for some reason, and he will glance down at her piles of books and exotic, interesting ornaments, demonstrating what an exotic, interesting woman she is, and he will make some sort of funny, perceptive, intelligent, but not scarily intelligent remark, and at that exact moment there will be some sort of minor crisis. Something will explode or flood or burst into flames. They will work together to overcome this crisis, which ideally will require some bicep-bulging strength on his part. And when it is over, they will flop down together, laughing with relief, and their eyes will meet, and they will both just know. That will be the moment Sophie will sneak a look at her watch to check the time that she met her future husband, so she can tell her future children. One problem is that she doesn't own a pair of overalls or any exotic, interesting ornaments. She'll also have to hide away her collection of Regency romances. She hates the condescending expressions new boyfriends get on their faces the first time they see her Regency romances, as though she's an adorable puppy. Oh, him, says Sophie vaguely. I'd forgotten about him. Claire gives a long, exaggerated snort of disbelief. Well, she wrote that letter months ago, says Sophie defensively. The guy is probably with someone now. Single men don't last long in Sydney, remember? They're snapped up. Besides which, what do I know about Connie's taste in men? You said you saw photos of her husband. You said he was a spunk. Sophie grins. That's true. Look, you really can't risk looking insipid the first time you meet this guy. You've got to go for it. It could be your one chance. You're not getting any younger. Yes, thank you, Claire. I'm just saying, if you seriously do want to have a family, you haven't got much time.